You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just how worried should we be about pesticide residues on the fresh fruits and veggies we're buying? Can we trust government standards? And are consumers avoiding the fresh produce that is a healthier choice for fear of pesticide residue? Let's explore just what's on the produce we're buying. With us now from Michigan State University is the founding director and the endowed chair of the Center for Research on Ingredient Safety, a.k.a. CRIS, Michael Holsapple. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
What kind of research do you do at CRIS?
CRIS is focused on ingredient safety. So our research really is intended to try to look at many of the ingredients that make their way into our foods, personal care products, consumer products, and try to address some of the issues associated with whether or not they're safe. And that could be real safety or perceived lack of safety.
So as a food scientist, you've got some 30 years experience as a toxicologist. So from your scientist point of view, how worried should the average consumer be about the effect of pesticides on that produce we're buying?
I think it's going to depend on the consumers. I think first and foremost, I'm a real big advocate of allowing folks to make choices. But I think one of the missions of CRIS really is to make the science accessible so that consumers and other decision makers can make evidence-informed decisions. You know, the research that I've done about the pesticide residues on foods would suggest that, by and large, consumers really don't have anything to fear about that.
And why do you say that? Why can you say that with certainty?
For the last 20-plus years, the USDA, the FDA, and the EPA, those are the three federal regulatory agencies that are involved with food safety. In particular, the USDA is engaged in a very impressive analysis of pesticide residues on commodities, and they will try to measure pesticide residues on tens of thousands of commodities on an annual basis. And those reports have now been published for, you know, in excess of the last 20 years. Their analysis shows that, you know, greater than 99% of the time, the pesticide residues that they measure, and again, this is on tens of thousands of products, are falling below and oftentimes significantly below the tolerances that are put forth by the FDA and the EPA to ensure that our food supply is safe.
You know, as you think about a pesticide, it's meant to kill pests, so they're not risk-free. Tell us more about the commonly used pesticides that might be on the apples or strawberries we're buying.
There's dozens of them. I mean, they have multiple classes. We all have to recognize that pesticides are inherently toxic because they are intended to kill pests. But the pesticides that we currently use are dramatically different from the pesticides that were used, you know, 20 years ago or so, the DDTs and the organophosphates. The pesticides today are not persistent. They don't bioaccumulate. And the rigor with which the EPA assesses a new pesticide is second only to the way that a drug might be tested in terms of its safety to go into man. So there's a lot of attention paid toward whether or not a pesticide candidate that's being put forth by a company is going to be safe for the uses that they have intended it to be used for.
So we have safeguards in place now that were not in place, for example, when DDT became present and widely used?
I think that they probably had standards in place when DDT was made, but DDT is sort of a legacy pesticide. Mm-hmm. It was something that maybe preceded the rigor with which the EPA currently assesses pesticides. I mean, again, the persistent bioaccumulative and toxic in this sense is not necessarily to the pest, but toxic to consumers. And there's a lot of attention paid towards susceptible populations like infants and children's, the elderly. You know, so the EPA now has specific studies intended to go ahead and address that unique susceptibility of some of the elements of our population. So I don't think it's safe to say that pesticides back 20 years ago weren't being regulated. They're just being regulated now with a great deal of rigor. And there's a lot more attention paid toward trying to translate what the toxicity might be to the consumer in the context of making sure that we're well away from any concentrations that would be thought or predicted to cause unsafe conditions for the consumers.
I'm talking with Michigan State University food scientist Michael Holsapple as we talk about the pesticides that are used on the fruits and veggies that we're buying. And Michael, every spring the Environmental Working Group comes out with something it calls its Dirty Dozen, listing the 12 products they say are most likely to come in contact with pesticides. Strawberries, apples, peaches, and celery have been singled out every single year for the past 10 years. What's your take on that list?
I think that the EWG certainly has the right to put forth that list. I don't have any qualms with that. I think it's very consistent with one of their objectives, which is they promise to help protect families from pesticides. That being said, I think that there's some context that's missing from the EWG list. We recently did an analysis of the last 10 years of the EWG Dirty Dozen, and that list that the EWG puts out is said to be based on the data that the USDA accumulates. So, for example, the USDA just completed its analysis in 2016, released its results earlier this year, and the EWG list comes out, you know, about a month later. So they're in lockstep with the USDA reports. When we went back and looked at the last 10 years, though, and again, you cited apples, peaches, strawberries, and celery, what we did find is that those four products were on every one of the list that the EWG had put out from 2007 to 2015. We went ahead and went back to the USDA reports, and this is, again, something that comes out under the aegis of their pesticide data program. But what I found a little bit disturbing was that in the 10 years of reports, there were a number of instances where the USDA simply didn't include apples, strawberries, peaches, or celery. In spite of that, the EWG included those commodities on their list. So there's a bit of a breakdown in terms of the communication between what the EWG claims and what they actually do produce. I don't know why they've selected those four commodities. But the important thing is that their analysis of those 10 years of reports from the USDA are inconsistent with the actual results that are in those reports. And again, as a food scientist, as a toxicologist, you know, one of the things that I've taken on as a challenge is to make sure that I make the science accessible so that consumers can make informed decisions. And that was the whole intent of doing this analysis.
And are consumers avoiding fresh fruits and vegetables because they're worried about pesticides, because they see something like this Dirty Dozen list and then decide I'm not buying it at all?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of fear out there. You know, if you mention the word genetically modified organism or GMO, if you mention pesticides, chemical residues on foods, there are going to be a number of people that are going to avoid those fruits and vegetables. And, you know, if you really think about it, if you think about our dietary guidelines, we all, as health practitioners, should be encouraging people to eat more fruits and vegetables and not necessarily less fruits and vegetables unless there's a really, really good reason to do so.
Does buying organic give us more protection from pesticides?
That's a premise, I think. The organics, you know, certainly don't allow conventional pesticides, but it would be false to state that organic produce is grown without the use of any pesticides. The pesticides that are used for organic produce are defined as being natural. But I think another point that's important to underscore is that the pesticides that fulfill the definition of natural are not subjected to the same scientific rigor as the conventional pesticides. They don't have to have data. If you want to put forth a possible organic pesticide, all you have to do is show that it fulfills the definition of natural. There's no data that has to be acquired. There's no potential residues that have to be measured on an annual basis. So it's really different the way that we grow organic produce versus conventional produce.
I want to talk a little about trust. Certainly, we all learned about government regulations in connection with the Flint water disaster. The EPA's lead and copper rule did not protect people in Flint. Earlier this year, unsealed court documents showed an EPA employee helping Monsanto defend its highest-selling pesticide. Why should people trust regulators to protect them from pesticides?
It's a great question. You know, I think it comes down, again, to a matter of choice. You know, frankly, if we can't trust our government, We're in a lot of trouble for a lot of different reasons because they have a lot of control over much of our lives, our day-to-day lives. Like any kind of a career choice, there are going to be mistakes made. So you could find folks that work in industry that have made mistakes. You can find academicians that have made mistakes. You can find doctors that have made mistakes. There's no excuse for what happened in Flint. That was a big mistake. But I don't think it's fair to necessarily indict all of our government employees because I know many of them, I've worked with many of them, and I think they have the public's best interest in mind. And if they didn't, I don't think that they'd continue to be working for the government or put in a position to go ahead and monitor either drug development or pesticide registrations, et cetera.
And also related to trust, there are people that question scientific research when private industry is funding any part of it. And Chris, I understand, receives some funding from companies like Dow Chemical and Monsanto. What do you do to build a firewall to keep your research and science separate from commercial concerns?
That's a great question, and it's something that I had a lot of thought about before I accepted the position to become the founding director of CRIS. We've got a number of different advisory groups located both on the campus of Michigan State University, and these are folks that are working in the VP's office for research and graduate studies. There's the director of the Ag Bioresearch. I mean, these are some very high-ranking folks that assist me in terms of overseeing the evolution of CRIS. We've also got a scientific advisory group and an external advisory group that do include representatives from industry, but they're balanced by representatives from other universities, from government, from NGOs. First and foremost, my mantra is always going to be that the industry, just because they provide some support to CRIS, does not mean that they own the process. Frankly, I always try to caution them that they really shouldn't want to own the process because then the credibility of CRIS would be undermined and we would have lost the whole vision that many of us have formulated for what CRIS is intended to do, which is really to work to provide the best possible science to investigate problems associated with ingredients. So, I mean, the firewalls are certainly there. I've got a lot of personal integrity invested in this, and I'm simply not going to allow the industry to undermine that. Whenever I talk about CRIS, I'm openly transparent about the fact that I have companies that provide some support. To date, all of that support has gone, all of the money that I've received from the CRIS members have gone into the endowment. So I'm not only the founding director, but I'm an endowed chair. So to date, none of the money that I've received from my industry members have been used to support any of the research that CRIS has been engaged in.
Michael Holzapfel is the founding director of the Center for Research on Ingredient Safety at Michigan State University. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Michael.
Well, thank you. I hope you have a great day.